He turned away, and the spectators fell back ahead of him and seemed to form a guard of honour as St. John and his lady sauntered casually from the room. The flag captain flung one furious glare at Clinton. "The Admiral wishes to speak with you, sir." And then he hurried after the departing couple, followed them down the curve of the staircase and caught up with them at the double doors of carved teak. "Mr. St. John, Admiral Kemp asked me to convey his compliments. He sets no store by the rash accusations of one of his junior captains. If he did, he would be obliged to send a party aboard your ship." "None of us would like that," St. John nodded, "nor the consequences." "Indeed," the flag captain assured him. "Nevertheless, the Admiral feels that, in the circumstances, you should take advantage of the next fair wind and tide to proceed on your passage. Please return my compliments to the Admiral and convey my assurance that I will clear the bay before noon." At that moment, the widow's coach came up, and St. John nodded distantly to the flag captain and handed the lady up the steps. From the deck of Black Joke, they watched the clipper raise her anchor, her master skillfully backing and filling his topsails to run up on her cable and break the anchor flukes out of the mud and sand of the bottom of the bay. As soon as it was free, he piled on his canvas, sail after sail bursting out in quick successive explosions of brilliant white, and Huron tore eagerly out of Table Bay on the southeast wind. She would be out of sight beyond the lighthouse at Moulie Point for almost 4 hours before Black Joke was ready to follow her out of the bay. The Admiralty powder barge was alongside, and all the elaborate precautions for taking on explosives were in force. The red swallowtail warning flag at the masthead, the boiler fires in the engine room extinguished, the crew barefooted, the decks kept wet with a constant stream from the hoses to prevent a chance spark, and each powder barrel carefully inspected for leakage as it came aboard. While the engineer refired his boilers, the last members of the Ballantyne expedition came aboard. Once again, Zuger's letters of introduction had proved invaluable, and together with his persuasive manner, had provided him with the most valuable addition so far to his expedition. Old Tom Harkness had warned him during the long night discussion, "Don't try to cross the Chimani Mani Mountains without a force of trained men. Beyond the narrow coastal belt there is only one law, and it is promulgated from the muzzle of a gun." On the strength of the letters, the commander of the Cape Town garrison had allowed Zuger to ask for volunteers from his regiment of Hottentot infantry. "They are only natives of Africa who understand the working of a firearm," Harkness had told him. "They are the devil with drink and women, but they can fight and march, and most of them are hardened to fever and famine. Pick them carefully and watch them every moment, night as well as day." Zuger's request for volunteers had been most enthusiastically received. By reputation, the Hottentots could scent plunder or a willing lady from 50 miles, and the pay and rations that Zuger offered were almost thrice that of the British Army. They had volunteered to a man, and Zuger's difficulty had been in selecting 10 of them. Zuger had taken an instant liking to these wiry little men, with their almost oriental features, slanted eyes and high cheekbones. Despite appearances, they were more African than almost any other breed. They were the original inhabitants that the first navigators had found on the beach at Table Bay, and they had taken readily to the white man's ways, and more than readily to his vices. Zuger had solved his problem by making one selection only. This was a man with an ageless face. It might have been 40 years or 80, for the skin was the colour and texture of papyrus parchment. Each wrinkle seemed to have been eroded into it by wind and driven dust, but the little peppercorns of hair that covered his skull were untinged with silver. "I taught Captain Harris to hunt elephant," he boasted. "Where was that?" Zuger demanded, for Cornwallis Harris was one of the most famous of the old African hunters. His book, The Wild Sports of Africa, was the great classic of the African chase. "I took him to the Kashan Mountains." Harris's expedition to the Kashan Mountains which the Boers now called Machalisberg, was in 1829, 31 years previously. That would make the little Hottentot somewhere between 50 and 60 years old, if he were telling the truth. "Harris did not mention your name," he said. "I have read his account carefully." "Jan Bloem. That was my name then." Zuger nodded. Bloem had been one of Harris's most intrepid hunter retainers. "Why is your name Jan Schroot now?" Zuger asked, and the dark eyes had twinkled with pixie merriment. "Sometimes a man gets tired of a name, like he does of a woman, and for his health or his life he changes both." The long military-issue Enfield rifle was as tall as Jan Schroot, but it seemed an extension of his wizened little body. "Pick 9 other men, the best," Zuger told him, and Sergeant Schroot brought them aboard while the gunboat was working up ahead of steam in her boilers. Each man carried his Enfield over his shoulder, his worldly possessions in the haversack on his back, and 50 rounds in the pouches on his belt. It needed only the rogue's march to welcome them, Zuger thought wryly, as he watched them come in through the entry port, each one bestowing upon him a beatific grin and a salute so vigorous that it nearly swung the donor off his feet. Sergeant Schroot lined them up at the rail. Their original scarlet uniform jackets had suffered strange mutations to 10 different shades, ranging from sun-faded pink to dusty puce, and each peppercorn head wore its brimless infantry cap cocked at a different angle from all the others. Thin shanks were bound up with grubby putties, and brown bare feet slapped the oak planking of the deck in unison as Schroot brought them to attention. Enfields at the slope and happy grins on each puckish face. "Very well, Sergeant," Zuger acknowledged the salute. "Now let's have the packs open and the bottles over the side." The grins wilted, and they exchanged crestfallen glances. The Major had looked so young and gullible. "You hear the Major, you'll a klomp dom skaper?" Gleefully, Jan Schroot likened them to a herd of stupid sheep in the kitchen dutch of the Cape, and as he turned back to Zuger, there was for the first time a gleam of respect in the dark eyes. There are two passages from which a ship may choose when sailing the southeastern coast of Africa. The master may stay outside the 100-fathom line, which marks the edge of the continental shelf, for here the opposing forces of the Mozambique current and the prevailing winds can generate a sea which seamen call with awe the 100-year wave. A wave over 200 foot from crest to trough, which will overwhelm even the sturdiest vessel as though it were a drifting autumn leaf. The alternative, and only slightly less hazardous passage, lies close inshore, in the shallows where the rocky reefs wait a careless navigator. For the sake of speed, Clinton Codrington chose the inshore passage, so that always the land was in sight as they bustled northwards. Day after day, the shimmering white beaches and dark rocky headlands unreeled ahead of Black Joke's bows, sometimes almost lost in the smoky blue sea fret, and at other times brutally clear under the African sun. He kept steam in his boilers, and the single bronze screws spinning under his counter with every sail set, and trained around to glean the smallest puff of the wind, as he drove Black Joke on to the rendezvous that Mungo St. John had set. His haste was symptom of a compulsion that Robin Ballantyne only began fully to understand during those days and nights that they drove east and north, for Clinton Codrington sought her company constantly, as she spent many hours of each day with him, or all of it that could be spared from the management of the vessel, beginning with the assembly of the ship's company for morning prayers. Most naval captains went through the motions of divine service once a week, but Captain Codrington held prayers every morning, and it did not take Robin long to realize that his faith and sense of Christian duty was, if anything, greater than her own. He did not seem to experience the terrible doubts and temptations to which he was always such a prey. And if it had not been unchristian to do so, she would have felt envy for his sense and secure faith. I wanted to go into the church like my father and my elder brother, Ralph, before me, he told her. Why did you not? The Almighty led me into the path he had chosen for me, Clinton said simply. And it did not seem pretentious when he said it. I know now he meant me to be a shepherd for his flock, here in this land. And he pointed at the silver beaches and blue mountains. I did not realize it at the time, but his ways are wonderful. This is the work he has chosen for me. Suddenly she realized how deep was his commitment to the war he was waging against the trade. It was almost a personal crusade, his whole being directed at its destruction, for he truly believed that he was the instrument of God's will. Yet, like many deeply religious men, he kept his belief closely guarded, never flaunting it in sanctimonious posturing or biblical quotation. The only time he spoke of his God was during the daily prayers and when he was alone with her on his quarterdeck. Quite naturally, he assumed that her belief matched, if not outstripped, his own. She did nothing to disillusion him, for she enjoyed his patent admiration, his deference to the fact that she had been appointed as a missionary. And when she was truthful to herself, which was more and more often these days, she liked the way he looked, the sound of his voice, and even the smell of him. It was a man's smell, like tanned leather, or the pelt of an otter she had once had as a pet at King's Lynn. He was good to be near, a man, as the pale missionary, initiates, and medical students she had known had not been men. He was the Christian warrior. She found a comfort in his presence, not like the wicked excitement of Mungo St. John, but something deeper and more satisfying. She looked upon him as her champion, as though the deadly assignation to which he was hurrying was on her behalf, to wipe out the knowledge of sin and to atone for her disgrace. On the third day they passed the settlement on the shore of Algoa Bay, where the 5,000 British settlers brought out by Governor Somerset 40 years before in 1820 had landed, and still eked a hard existence from the unforgiving African earth. The white flecks of painted walls looked pitifully insignificant in that wilderness of water and sky and land, and at last Robin started to come to some small understanding of the vastness of this continent and how puny were the scratches that man had made upon it. For the first time she felt a small, cold dread at her own temerity that had brought her so far, so young and so inexperienced, to venture she was not sure what. She hugged her shawl about her shoulders and shivered in the cutting wind that poured in off the green sea. The Africa she had dreamed of so often seemed harsh and unwelcoming now. As Black Joke closed swiftly with the rendezvous that St. John had appointed, Clinton Codrington became quieter and was more often alone in his cabin. He understood clearly the ordeal that faced him. Zuga Ballantyne had discussed it with him on almost every occasion that presented itself. Zuga was unwavering in his opposition to the meeting. "You have chosen a formidable opponent, sir," he told Clinton bluntly, "and I mean no offence when I say I doubt you are a match for him with either pistol or sword. But he'll choose pistols, you can wager on that." "He challenged," Clinton said quietly. "My weapon is the naval cutlass. We will fight with those." "I cannot support you there," Zuga shook his head. "If there was a challenge, and I could make a case against that, but if there was one, it came from you, sir. If you fight, it'll be with pistols." Day after day he tried to persuade Clinton to miss the rendezvous. "Damn it, man, nobody fights duels anymore, especially against a man who can spit the cheroot in your mouth with either hand at 20 paces. Or again, "There was no challenge, Captain Codrington. I was there, and I would stake my honour on it." At another time, "You will lose your commission, sir. You have Admiral Kemp's direct order to avoid the meeting, and it is obvious that Kemp is waiting for an opportunity to haul you before a court-martial." Then again, "By God, sir, you will serve no one least of all yourself by being shot to death on some deserted and godforsaken shore. If St. John is a slaver, then your chance to take him at more favourable odds will come later."